This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 18th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, comments from presidential candidate Mitt Romney made at a Florida fundraiser draw criticism for his economic and foreign policies. Activists gather in New York to call for an end to solitary confinement and mass incarceration. And we'll go to Syria, where fighting and violence sends residents fleeing across the country, putting strain on local communities. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen confirmed today that the U.S.-led international force in Afghanistan will scale back on-the-ground partner patrols with local forces. Some say such partnerships have reduced the number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The move was originally revealed Sunday and attributed to a recent uptick of attacks against NATO forces by Afghan security, known as green-on-blue attacks. Rasmussen said today that the change in strategy will not affect the end date for troop withdrawal.
The overall strategy, it remains the same, that we will continue to hand over in a gradual process lead responsibility for the security to the Afghan security forces, and that process will be completed by the end of 2014. And our ISAF combat mission will end by the end of 2014. Nothing has changed.
Officials also hope the move will minimize risk to foreign forces as protests against a film that ridicules Islam and the Prophet Muhammad continue across the region and around the world. In Bangkok today, hundreds protested outside the U.S. embassy, which closed hours before, and Indian-administered Kashmir came to a standstill before protests turned violent in the summer capital, Srinagar. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
The shutdown against the anti-Islam film evoked a near-total response in most parts of the Muslim-dominated Kashmir Valley. Shops and businesses were shut, and transport was off the roads. Protesters gathered at many places in the capital Srinagar and in other towns as well. They chanted anti-US and anti-Israel slogans and burned US flags and effigies of Barack Obama. A protest march turned violent near the central city when protesters set fire to a government vehicle parked outside the residence of Deputy Chief Minister Tara Chand. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd, who hurled stones in return. Protests against the film have been held in the region since Friday. Calling the film a conspiracy of the West, they want punishment for the filmmaker. A police spokesperson said that except for the vehicle burning incident, most protests around the region today remained peaceful. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
This evening in Fullerton, California, the city's acting police chief is expected to tell the city council that Kelly Thomas, a mentally disabled homeless man, did absolutely nothing to provoke the police beating that led to his death. Lena Nozizwe has more.
On July 5th of last year, officers responded to a call that someone was vandalizing cars. Police questioned Thomas and later reported that he resisted arrest, but surveillance video shows nothing of the kind. Rather, it reveals an unprovoked, brutal beating by six police officers, at the end which Thomas is crying out for his daddy. He died 5 days later. Fullerton Mayor Pro Tem Bruce Whitaker says tonight's statement is almost unprecedented.
It could certainly have gravity in the case, in both the criminal case and the civil case that Mr. Thomas has brought against the city, because it could be considered an admission that the officers weren't acting within full scope of their authority.
So far, two officers have been charged in the killing. One is still under investigation, and three city council members have been recalled. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Thousands of platinum miners in South Africa will go back to work on Thursday after agreeing to a 22% pay raise. The strike at the UK-based Lonmin mine outside of Johannesburg lasted 5 weeks. 34 strikers died when police tried to squelch the protest. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court sent the state's voter ID law back to a lower court today. The state's high court ordered another look at the availability of alternate ID cards to make sure that voters have free and easy access to non-driver's license identification. But State Department of Transportation officials readily admit they still require rigorous documentation. Today's ruling doesn't overturn the voter ID law, but does order the lower courts to suspend the law if voters don't have liberal access to ID or if disenfranchisement will occur. And Chicago teachers are still on the picket line today. Union officials are meeting this afternoon to review a proposed contract and consider calling off the strike. If they don't, tomorrow morning a judge will hear Mayor Rahm Emanuel's request to order them back to work. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In a leaked video of a private fundraiser, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney told a crowd of wealthy donors in Florida that his campaign would never win over certain Obama supporters, especially those with low incomes.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
Romney added that it isn't his job to worry about those people. The May fundraiser was held in the Boca Raton home of private equity manager Mark Leader. The admission cost $50,000 per plate. When footage of the event began appearing on the YouTube account Romney Exposed last month, the grandson of former President Jimmy Carter contacted the anonymous source and put him or her in touch with the nonprofit news organization Mother Jones, who began publishing the video segments this week. More clips published today show Romney explaining his thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and include remarks some peace advocates called damaging. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Though he's publicly supported a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, Mitt Romney told more than 100 major donors in a private Florida mansion this spring that a pathway to peace in the Middle East is almost unthinkable.
These are problems that are very hard to solve, all right? And I look at the Palestinians not wanting to see peace anyway, for political purposes, committed to the destruction and elimination of Israel, and these thorny issues, and I say, there's just no way.
Romney went on to lay out his proposed solution to the ongoing conflict.
And so what you do is you say you move things along the best way you can, you hope for some degree of stability, but you recognize this is going to remain an unsolved problem. I mean, we live with that in China and Taiwan. All right, we have a potentially volatile situation, but we sort of live with it. And we kick the ball down the field and hope that ultimately somehow something will happen and resolve it.
After the video was widely distributed Tuesday, many human rights groups and political analysts criticized Romney for characterizing all Palestinians as anti-Israel and anti-peace, and for refusing to take action. One of them was Yusuf Munayer with the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., who called Romney's statements troubling and misinformed.
He essentially says there's nothing we can do about this situation. The thing is, most U.S. presidents arrive at that conclusion after at least making some sort of attempt. Presidents in recent history have all been engaged at one level or another in peacemaking efforts. And we can have a long conversation about how effective those were and what the mistakes were that were involved. But they've all at least attempted.
Munayer says while President Obama has not made such disparaging remarks about the Palestinian people, he has not helped the peace process either. He said the Obama administration's unconditional support for Israel, including military aid and diplomatic support in United Nations disputes, undermines its role of impartial mediator.
If you look at what the Obama administration has actually done, it has been very clearly pro-Israel. And so while we're talking about an independent Palestinian state that's viable and contiguous in the West Bank out of one side of our mouth, on the other side, we are acting for the exact opposite. And so that is a central problem that needs to be rectified if U.S. Mediation of this conflict is ever going to be taken seriously by all the players involved.
Though Romney's fundraiser remarks on Palestine do break from his statements in interviews with Haaretz and other newspapers, they are in line with many of his foreign policy advisors and major pro-Israel donors, something he noted in his speech.
I have a very good team of extraordinarily experienced, highly successful consultants. They do races all over the world, in Armenia, in Africa, in Israel. work for Bibi Netanyahu and his race, and so they do these races and they see which ads work and which processes work best, and we have ideas about what we do over the course of the campaign. I tell them to you, but I have to, shoot you.
Romney's team of foreign policy advisors includes former Blackwater executive Kofor Black, former Dick Cheney advisor Eric Edelman, and several members of neoconservative groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Romney has also received tens of millions of dollars from pro-Israel casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. As criticism over the leaked video mounts, Romney called a last-minute press conference late Monday evening. Though he admitted the answers to donors' questions weren't elegantly stated, he defended the basic premise of what was said. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
National League for Democracy Chair Aung San Suu Kyi is in the United States for the first time in more than two decades as part of her 17-day-long trip. She's scheduled to meet with congressional leaders and activist groups. Speaking in Washington, D.C. today, the opposition leader from Myanmar, also known as Burma, said the government in her country has made steps toward democratic reform, but more still needs to be done.
Burma had certainly started out on the process of democratization. But how far will it go? How sustainable is it? How genuine is it? Those are the questions.
Suu Kyi won a popular election in 1990, but was denied office by a military junta and put under house arrest for two decades. After being released in 2010, she was elected to parliament. She credited Myanmar's president, Thein Sein, with allowing some changes, such as a release of a limited number of political prisoners, and urged the U.S. and other countries to be watchful of the process.
I believe that he is keen on democratic reforms. But how the executive goes about implementing these reforms is what we have to watch.
After decades of isolation and military rule, Myanmar has become one of the poorest countries in the region. Repression of ethnic communities such as the Rohingya is also a major concern. According to the UN, Myanmar has nearly 800,000 people who are refugees or internally displaced, many of whom rely on emergency aid. This summer, the Obama administration lifted a ban on investment in Myanmar, but Aung San Suu Kyi said opening economic markets had to be connected to reforms in civil and government institutions.
New U.S.-Burma bilateral relations, I would like to be founded firmly in the recognition of the need to give equal weight to the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, and to judge the progress of democratization in Burma by how strong all these institutions are and how well able to work together as a whole to establish democratic practices in our country.
Suu Kyi met with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today. She's scheduled to receive the Congressional Gold Medal Wednesday. Myanmar President Thein Sein is also scheduled to visit the U.S. next week. Today in Syria, residents reported clashes in homes between government forces and opposition fighters and gunfire in Hama. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, government forces struck areas in Aleppo and Idlib province where the bombing destroyed houses and injured civilians. A video posted online today showed residents digging through a destroyed building to uncover the body of a young man who was motionless and beneath chunks of debris. A group of men cover him with a blanket and carry him out into the street. On Tuesday, the UN Human Rights Commission said human rights violations in Syria were increasing in number, pace, and scale. Abuses are also being credited to anti-government fighters. Human Rights Watch documented 12 cases of summary executions of suspected government fighters by groups connected to the opposition. Both groups said civilians continue to be affected the most. Earlier today, we spoke with Ibrahim Zaidan via Skype from Idlib province. He began by describing the daily daily attacks that come from air assaults in his area.
They come out in the morning between 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. and in the evening before the sunset about 6 o'clock. This is a daily program. All the residents here get used to it. And when the warplanes or helicopters go in the sky, or the people see these warplanes in the sky, they know that a massacre will be committed by these warplanes.
Is there any humanitarian organization, any outside aid groups that are providing food or supplies to people who need it in that area?
No, sir. For example, sometimes, but it's very poor, because in the especially and in the southern countryside, as it is a free of military here, there is a lot of people who come from Hama and from the eastern and western countryside, because it is shelled every day. So people fled their villages and towns and came here to this area. The village, which consisted in the past of about 20,000 people, now it has about 40 or 50,000 people. All of them are out of the village and live here because it is safer in these villages.
As you're describing the situation there, people coming in from other areas, a place of 20,000 going to 40 or 50,000, that's doubling or more than doubling. Where do these people go to live? Is there enough shelter for people who are coming into your area?
People shares here, people has share houses, and a lot of people are living in mosques and in schools. All of our schools and mosques are full of families because the houses were full.
That's Ibrahim Zaidan, a resident of Idlib province, speaking to us via Skype from inside Syria. Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues are investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people, and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. Opponents of solitary confinement continue their efforts to raise awareness about the harmful effects of the practice, including severe psychological and physical effects to inmates and the high cost for prisons. In advance of a hearing today in Philadelphia on the issue, activists gathered in New York City to hear from some of the most visible activists fighting to end both solitary confinement and mass incarceration. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
More than 2,500 people crowded into Manhattan's Riverside Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke 45 years ago, calling for social equality and an end to white supremacy. Social justice advocates, including Cornel West, Mark Lamont Hill, and Mamia Abu-Jamal, continued that message in their call to end mass incarceration.
Post-correctional institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Former death row inmate Abu-Jamal delivered a recorded speech from a Pennsylvania state prison. He described the effect of solitary confinement on fellow prisoners.
I've seen men driven mad as a hatter by soul-crushing loneliness. Men who have sliced their arms until they look like railroad tracks, or sliced their necks, or burned themselves alive. For solitary is torture, state torture, official torture, government-sanctioned torture.
Although exact figures from solitary confinement are difficult to establish, two studies using census data from 2000 and 2005 estimated about 80,000 prisoners in some type of restricted housing. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, questions its aggressive use against prisoners like Bradley Manning, a U.S. soldier charged for leaking classified information to WikiLeaks.
He never committed a violent act. He never, you know, did anything to harm anybody, let alone himself. So, you know, to keep him in those conditions for so many months amounts to pain and suffering that's associated with cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
After studying the impact on prisoners, Mendez concluded that more than 15 days in solitary confinement is inhumane. But in the U.S., the practice has grown over the last few decades. What was once a temporary measure has become long-term, with some prisoners spending months, years, or even decades in dark, cramped cells with no human interaction for up to 23 hours a day.
Torture, the definition of torture is usually the infliction of pain by a state actor, where the degree of pain is very severe, where the purpose could be for gaining information or interrogation, or for the purpose of producing severe pain and suffering.
Elena Landrisina is a former legal intern at the Prison Rights Project, a nonprofit that enforces the legal right of New York City prisoners. She says the U.S. lacks federal policies to protect inmates.
Some countries have agreed to have independent monitors come in and analyze whether the conditions are conditions that produce torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and the U.S., of course, doesn't.
So in other words, prisons are a conflict of interest in themselves?
Yeah. The New York State prisons employ doctors and mental health professionals who come in and assess whether someone is suffering and to such a degree that they should be put in observation. And I'm sure that they have good intentions and that they're doing their job to the best of their ability, but they're also reporting to the officials who run the prison.
While the Office of Mental Health is a separate institution from the Department of Corrections, Landrisina says it's still troubling both tolerate the use of disciplinary solitary confinement. But some states are trying to change that. In California and Colorado, plaintiffs have filed suits against their respective state prisons, arguing solitary confinement violates the Eighth Amendment ban against cruel and unusual punishment. Lawmakers on the state and federal level are also paying more attention. This summer, the U.S. Senate held its first ever hearing on solitary confinement. This week, Pennsylvania's Democratic Policy Committee is holding another hearing. Organizers of the hearing say it's needed to reform state prison policies in Pennsylvania. Abu Jamal says it's going to take more than that.
Build a movement that does not seek reform. Build a movement that seeks revolutionary transformation in the prison industrial complex.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee is currently working on legislation to make it more difficult for prisoners to use solitary confinement. On the state level, Colorado officials decided to shut down part of a prison that contained about 300 solitary confinement beds. According to the ACLU, the move will save the state about $17 million over the next 2 years. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn also announced the closure of the Tam Supermax prison. But the closure is currently held up in the courts, following a lawsuit by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN.
To hear Mumia Abu-Jamal's entire recorded commentary on mass incarceration and solitary confinement, visit FSRN.org. In Canada, the anniversary of the Occupy movement coincided with the opening of Parliament. In the capital, Ottawa, Occupy members joined union leaders and other activists in marching through the streets towards the steps of the nation's legislature, calling for the resignation of Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper. FSRN's Tanya Castle reports.
On the footsteps of Canada's Parliament, about 200 people of all ages and walks of life rally against Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Some wear pins reading, "Stephen Harper hates me," and brandish placards stating, "I am the 99%. Stop Harper, and we are all affected," referring to the deep government cuts to social programs across the country. Miranda Dyke, a mother and political analyst, was at the protest with her two young children. She was there to show her solidarity with the 99% in Canada and around the world.
For me, it's about being part of the global movement. Just a minute, sweetie. It's about being a part of the worldwide movement of the 99%, just standing up and saying that, you know, the 1% doesn't deserve to have it all, that there are people who are starving, there are people who are really struggling, and we're starting to see a lot more of that in Canada under Harper's government.
Activists say under Harper's reign, economic inequality is rising, and so are affronts to human rights, democracy, women's rights, indigenous rights, and the environment. Since Harper took office in 2006, he shut down the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development, a government-funded watchdog agency, and the Court Challenges Program, which provided funds to support test cases against discriminatory laws. He's also slashed funding for the Canadian Human Rights Commission and for Status of Women Canada, resulting in office closures across the country for both.
Now there's a group of walkers who've been walking here since May Day, May 1st. A group of about 10 people.
Protest MC Lana Goldberg, a member of Occupy Toronto and political science student at York University, adds to the long list of Harper's assaults on Canadian values and people.
This last omnibus budget bill killed environmental regulation, research, and monitoring. This regime has been approving pipelines and other mining projects with complete disregard for Indigenous communities. I mean, it's just atrocious what's happening right now, and I felt like we needed to make a stand, let this regime know that we are paying attention and we're not going to stand for it.
Currently, the Northern Gateway oil pipeline, if approved, would carry tar sands oil from Alberta through British Columbia's wilderness to the Pacific coast. According to recent polls, it is opposed by more than half of British Columbia's residents, and more than 100 Indigenous groups have filed legal action against it as it passes through their land. Harper's environmental record is one of the reasons Adam McLaren, a freelance videographer, is attending the protest. He says he wants to find out more. He wants to know how Harper is getting away with these policies.
The majority of the issues that I have are the environmental issues, like pipeline straight to through BC and everything like that. Those are the things that I feel really strongly about, that I feel are incredibly wrong and dangerous, and the fact that the majority of people don't want it, and yet it's still like trying to be pushed through, it's mind-boggling to me.
Participants in Tuesday's rally emphasized their concerns about the widening gap between the rich and the poor in Canada and the erosion of equality. 73-year-old artist Linda Luneau, like Mother Miranda Dyke, was one of them. She says Canada is just not the place it used to be.
Right now I just feel this is a Canada that I'm not proud of at all. And even though there were many errors made in other governments, and maybe I didn't agree with a lot of policy, there was still a social concern that we just are not seeing now. And equality is disappearing.
I ain't gonna study.
Anniversary Occupy protests were also held in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, and other cities across Canada. All called on the removal of Harper. The next protest will be October 15th. Tanya Castle, FSRN, Ottawa, Canada.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.